Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
I was always a dreamer. I always saw a life beyond the life that I had as a child.
It was like a big flashing light. This is what you're supposed to do.
Everybody poo-pooed the idea. Network said it couldn't be done.
You're in that zone, and it's that out-of-body experience where it just, everything clicks.
Sometimes you have those dark moments. I was so depressed when I got fired.
I was so mad.
People don't need to be afraid to fail. And again, that's where you learn. You shouldn't be afraid of adversity. You know, that is the thing that makes you strong.
This is Jerry Levias.
This is Jody Markell.
This is Chi Young.
This is Dick Vitale, and you're listening to American Achievers.
Welcome to American Achievers, the podcast that celebrates ambition, commitment to excellence, risk-taking, and tenacity on the road to success. I'm Keith Dunovant. Some of my guests are world-famous. Some are rather obscure. Our weekly lineup includes entrepreneurs, athletes, military heroes, civic leaders, artists, and media figures. What they all have in common is a sense of undeniable purpose and an intriguing story that reflects the power of the American dream. Most of us are so lucky. We all know people who have been dealt a very difficult hand in life. But sometimes there is a fine line between debilitating disability and rare gift. This week we spotlight a man who has managed to overcome tremendous obstacles to become a force in the music business. Michael Cleveland was born blind, and as a child, lost most of his hearing in one ear. For years, he was surrounded by adults telling him what he could never do. And his universe was pretty dark, until he discovered the magic in his right hand. It didn't take the music world long to recognize the young boy from Indiana as a virtuoso. He began chasing something he could see, but only in his mind. Vince Gill, the country music superstar, once called Cleveland's fiddle playing fearless. Indeed, he plays with a remarkable ferocity. Cleveland and his band Flamekeeper won a Grammy in 2019, and he has been named Bluegrass Fiddle Player of the Year 12 times. Join me for an inspirational conversation with one of the greatest bluegrass fiddlers ever to wield a bow. When did you realize that you were different, that you were blind?
Boy, that's a very good question. I guess it had to be before I started school, you know. I think there was a, which I don't remember this, but there's a scene in a documentary that was made about me where they were interviewing my mom, and they were talking about how, yeah, I guess this when I was real little, and yeah, I would be feeling my mom's face, and then I, you know, feel like my grandma's face, and then I guess I asked, you know, my grandma, you know, I called her Nana all the time, and I said, you know, Nana, can you see me? And she said, yeah, I could see you. And then I think I just said something like, well, how come I can't see you? And I don't know, I guess that might have been when I first realized. I definitely realized once I went to the school for the blind. And being around other people who were, you know, had different degrees of visual impairment, and but yeah, I guess that would have been the first.
Well, that first day at the Kentucky School for the Blind, that must have been pretty tough. Tell me about that first day.
Well, Yeah, it was pretty tough. I mean, you know, what kid wants to go to school when they're 4 years old anyway? But, like, I think the hardest thing for me to get used to, because, well, I'm from southern Indiana. I'm from Henryville, Indiana, which is just a small town about 20 miles away from Louisville, Kentucky, something like that. And so it's just right across the river. And so technically, I should have went to the Indiana School for the Blind, which was in Indianapolis, which is about 100 miles away. And Mom obviously didn't want to send me 100 miles away and was trying to figure out a way to have me go to Louisville, to the Kentucky School for the Blind. And the way they worked it out is my dad had this friend, Gary Miller, who worked at Pepsi with him. My dad was a truck driver for years. And so Gary became my legal guardian, Gary and his wife, Jenny, who lived in Louisville. And that enabled me to go to the Kentucky School for the Blind and be about 20 miles away from home versus 100. But still, I mean, they dropped me off at the dorm that first night, and that was terrible. And I mean, it wasn't that. I mean, I don't think I'd have been happy wherever I was. You know, I think the big thing was just not. You know, they dropped me off on Sunday, and they said, "All right, we'll see you Friday," and you know, Friday seemed like forever. And there was a kid who was my roommate at the school who his name was Josh Mullins, and he would from the first day he would just start saying, "Hey, you're here forever now. You're never gonna go home again." And I of course I was 4 years old, you know, and I didn't know the difference, you know, if somebody was teasing or what at that time. So, I mean, I believed him, and he said it over and over and over again. And so I just knew for a fact that I was going to be in this dorm with people I didn't know forever. And then, you know, I went to school, and, you know, now the school itself, and obviously, you know, once I got used to it and figured out I was definitely going to go home. That Friday when I went home, I was just shocked, you know. But now the school, I do think that if had I not went to a school for the blind, I would have had a lot of trouble, because, you know, like for a kid who is visually impaired, having a public school teacher once a week, you know, maybe if you could see a little bit, and you know, that could be one thing. But for a totally blind kid to have just a teacher once a week come into a public school, that's just not enough. And you know, the hands-on learning and also being around people that are like, you know, people that were also blind, not only kids, but teachers who work there, and just seeing how they just killed it. Because, I mean, it's true. Like, there's blind people in about any profession that you can think of, other than maybe brain surgery or something like that. But, I think that was really good for me, and just learning ways, you know, to do things that I probably wouldn't have been able to learn in a public school.
Were you able to kind of wrap your arms around the fact that, as tough as this was, that your mom and dad were doing something for your own good?
Yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, it took a little while to figure that out, you know, but yeah, obviously anything that my parents did, you know, they did for my own good. And I'm glad and I'm very grateful that they did, you know, and, you know, was that or go to Indianapolis and be 100 miles away, and, or be in a public school in Henryville, Indiana, you know, which wouldn't have helped at all.
Well, looking back on that situation now, I mean, how did you avoid just being, you talking about this little twerp that was teasing you, how did you avoid being pulled into, you know, despair about your circumstances?
No, it was pretty real. And I mean, it was ongoing for a while, you know, like this kid, he was relentless every day, man. That's what I heard from him. And it wasn't until I went home the first time and my parents talked to me, and, you know, of course I didn't, apparently I just came home and just sat and wouldn't do anything. And I guess I was in shock. I guess I was in disbelief that I was there. But, you know, from after that, obviously I figured out that he was teasing, you know, but, I don't know. I was a pretty trusting kid, you know, like I don't know that I'd been lied to all that much. And so I really didn't know how to take it.
Tell me about around that time when you would go to your grandparents and you would listen to eight track tapes of, I guess, mostly bluegrass at that point, putting your head up next to the speaker. Tell me about that.
And that was even before that. Like, I don't remember very much about, you know, things before the School for the Blind, but I do know that I was into the music before, and that, I mean, I would go to bluegrass shows with my grandparents every weekend and then go over to their house and listen to their records. And I mean, I loved bluegrass, and I was just totally into it. They would say all the time, people around this area have told me, I remember seeing you in a stroller when you were a little kid, just keeping perfect time. And so, yeah, that was before the School for the Blind. And then around the time I started school, I think I heard a fiddle player play Orange Blossom Special. And that was the thing that really, I mean, I just knew at that moment that I had to learn how to play, even if it was just to learn how to play that song.
And what was it about the fiddle in particular?
I really don't know. There was just something about that song, something about the train sound, something about that. I can't put my finger on what it was exactly that grabbed me about it, other than, you know, the train sounds, of course, you know, for a little kid, those are pretty cool. And then the, just the tempo, you know, the sheer speed of it and the energy, which is still what grabs me about bluegrass music, you know. It's like the, you know, not only, you know, the speed or whatever, but the intensity with, you know, that people play with. And that's in any kind of music, not only bluegrass, you know, but like you can have a great musician who is technically able to just shred and play all the notes perfectly and all that. But man, the players that really grab me are the ones that have something behind it. And you can just, you know, like you can play the notes and then you can play the notes and actually be in the song and make somebody feel what you're feeling.
And that's what people say about you.
Well, that's what I shoot for. You know, when I first started playing, or when I told my folks and my grandparents that I wanted to play, the first thing that they did is they checked with there's this great fiddle player, Jeff Guernsey, who is still one of my musical heroes. He's like one of the best musicians that nobody's ever heard of. And but I can't really say nobody, but you know, like he played out on the road with Vince Gill and Steve Warner and played with all these people, but he never really pursued it apart from that. You know, he just teaches now, and he does, he's out playing some, but just tremendous musician. And so he lived in Henryville also, and my grandparents asked him about giving me lessons, and he didn't know how to teach me, you know, the especially the bow, because I was blind. And so when I started there at the Kentucky School for the Blind, then they had a classical music program, and they had the taught the Suzuki method. And so that's how I started. And it was probably a couple of years before I could even play anything. It was pretty slow going to start. But yeah, I mean, I got to a point, I probably got to where I was, I'd say, decent by the time I was 8 or 9, you know, something like that, where I could jam. You know, where I could actually play the songs, you know, and at that point, yeah, I was playing in a couple local bands.
And you had a moment around that time when you got to play with the great Bill Monroe.
I did, yeah. My grandparents, they said they had taken me to Bean Blossom when I was real little, and I don't even know, you know, probably, you know, 1 or 2 years old. You know, I was scared to death of Bill Monroe. And then, of course, once I got into bluegrass and really playing and stuff, they said, man, let's go to Bean Blossom. And so what I didn't realize is at Bean Blossom, they used to have this thing called the Sunset Jam. And it happened every Friday evening. And they would set up a few microphones by this, I think it was like an old oak tree or something there, Bean Blossom. You know, there's a place they always had it. And they set up a few mics, and anybody in the park could jam with Bill Monroe. And so you can imagine all the musicians that, you know, came over there. And I mean, it was Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys, you know, the whole band up there. And
was there
the other band.
Was there somebody off to the side with a gong giving you about 3 seconds to make it or not?
No. Uh-uh. So, I mean, just, I think I was playing along and maybe took a solo or something, and then somebody, maybe Tater, somebody, his fiddle player, said something about, you know, hey, here's a fiddle player here, and Bill said, hey, we got a good little fiddle player. I got a video of him somewhere, but there's this good little fiddle player over here on the right-hand side. What is your name, boy? And, of course, I was scared to death, you know, and I told him my name, and he asked what I wanted to play, and of course I played the Orange Blossom Special, and it was really fun, you know. I wish I could go back and do it again. I wish I could do it all again now, knowing what I was in the middle of, which I did have an idea. I knew for a fact that it was Bill Monroe, the father of bluegrass. But at the same time, when you're a kid, you don't really appreciate what you're in the middle of. And you take things for granted that, you know, when you look back on them later, it's like, man, I actually did that. Can you believe that? You know?
What was your ambition as that at that point as a little kid?
I wanted to be a cop. I wanted to carry a gun.
Really?
Oh God, yeah. I was into music, and I got into like mystery, not like I watched a bunch of mystery and cop shows, and then I liked reading, and I still like reading like suspense thrillers and, you know, all that kind of thing on audiobooks. And man, for a while there, when I was about 8 or 9, I thought I was going to be a cop. But, I had a couple little things, you know, when you're a kid, you think you want to do, you know, but I love to play music. You know, music was the one thing that I just came back to, and always, whether I practiced every day or not, you know, and I never did practice as much as the music teacher thought I should. But, you know, like if there was something I was working on, I would just go and go and go until I had whatever it was. And, you know, it could be hours, and then, you know, there might be days where I didn't pick it up at all. And I have a lot of parents ask me, how do you get your kids to practice? You know, how often do you practice? The thing is, my parents never made me practice. My parents never pushed me to play music. I had no choice but to play music. And it's just something that I loved. And it's something that I still love doing. And I think if you're going to be any good at music or whatever it is you're doing, it's got to be something that you love. And no parent telling you you need to play or anybody else is going to make that happen.
But the dedication that you clearly had to be really good, where did that come from?
You know, I'm not really sure other than I just... I think I just had it in my mind. Like I always dreamed of being in a band. And I think I wanted to do it so bad that I, you know, any spare moment during the day, you know, I was thinking about music. And, you know, if I was daydreaming in school, chances are I was thinking about music. And I would listen to those albums and stop and start and rewind and fast forward and just listen to them so much that you get that stuff ingrained in your head and then you can hear it. And I mean, that's, and I could at a certain point have a lot better, easier time of figuring out how to play that stuff.
What was the toughest part of you know, making that transition from you know, being a good fiddle player to being a great fiddle player? What was that? What was the toughest part of that?
Well, that's a good question. You know, it's still, it depends on what you're doing, really, because I mean, I got stuff now that I play that's just as hard as or way more complicated than the stuff. And it's like, it's never that you learn everything, or it's never that you, or I guess it shouldn't be, in my opinion, that you get to a point, it's like, all right, I'm happy with my playing, I don't need to learn anymore. Yeah, you know, so I never did get to a point, and I hope I never do, where I just feel like, yeah, I've mastered the instrument. And, you know, there's nothing else for me to do, and there's nowhere else for me to go. That'd be a sad day.
You're 80% deaf in your right ear. Did that affect how you developed as a fiddle player?
It probably did. I'm not sure if I'm 80% in my right ear. It might be a little less than that, and then the left ear is quite a bit worse. But, it could have affected, and I've, one of the guys in my band has said before that the reason I play so hard or so aggressively is just because of my hearing loss in my left ear. And, you know, you hold your fiddle on the left side. So his thinking is that if I could hear really well out of that left ear, I probably wouldn't play so hard. Maybe so.
Well, you play, you just play with a ferocity that is difficult to explain. Where does that come from?
That's, well, I mean, all I could say is that like I told you before, I always liked the people who played like that. And, you know, fiddle players like Benny Martin and Scotty Stoneman and all those bluegrass guys, they were aggressive. You know, the guys from the 50s, 60s, you know, they got in there and some of them were smoother, you know, than others. But, man, the one thing that those guys had was that intensity. And, you know, like, that's always what I liked, and that's always what I went for, is not only to play, but to play with drive and to play with rhythm, you know, like when you're playing Sally Gooden or something on the fiddle, you know, you could play it pretty much all separate bows or, you know, separate notes or whatever. But if you get a good swing to your bow and, you know, kind of, and, you know, you can groove with it. And that's the thing, you know, that's what makes bluegrass or any kind of music, is the rhythm and the intensity of it to me. And that's, you know, like when I say intensity, I don't mean just fast, because so many people hear what I play or what we do, and they just think, oh yeah, it's fast, you know? And yeah, we do play fast, but the thing is, if you can't play with a groove, if you can't, you know, play with that, you can play with intensity playing a slow song, playing a waltz. And yeah, it's personality. That's all I know how to say. It's my personality. And man, anytime I get to play, it doesn't matter what it is, I love to play. And you know, if it's time to play a solo, I'm in that moment, and it's time to go. You know, I've always been that way. It's just all in, all or nothing.
You're listening to American Achievers. Stay tuned for more conversation.
How do you keep challenging yourself to find that other floor that you're going for?
Well, a couple things that have really expanded, I guess, my, you know, toolbox or what I do, you know, is a few years ago, I got set up to record tracks here at the house. And that's been kind of an ongoing process that I've been improving and building on. But I really got going about, you know, pretty close to before the pandemic. And I got to where I built quite a few relationships. People were sending me stuff to play on, you know. So if they have a song that, say, they needed a fiddle part on, you know, they'd send it to me via Dropbox, and I would, you know, now import it into Pro Tools and be able to work on it at home here, and then send it back to them, and somehow it all lines up. You know, technology is really amazing these days, and it's making all this stuff easier now than it ever has been. And so the one thing that that did for me was I started getting all kinds of stuff, all kinds of music to play on, not just bluegrass. So I never know what I'm going to get asked to play on. It could be a country track. It could be bluegrass. It could be rock. It could be Americana. It could be jazz. It could be, I played on a thing the other day. I got an order from somebody in Germany. I couldn't understand a word they were saying, you know, but you play along with it. And it's really been great as far as challenging me to not only figure out something to play, but, you know, where is my piece in this? What can I do to not only play a part in this song that will work, but elevate the song? You know, is there a signature thing that I can latch on to that might make a good hook for the song that, you know, like, I mean, you think of Smoke on the Water, you know, if you didn't hear dun, 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 it wouldn't be Smoke on the Water, you know? So you got all these hook lines, you know, these musical hooks that are within these songs. You know, it's just all these things that I didn't used to think about that, you know, when you become a session musician, which is, you know, I guess part of what I am, you know, you have to listen in a different way, you know, and that's been really good for me. And then the second thing in the last few years or so, a couple of years, it's really pushed me is learning all the music for Bela Flex, My Bluegrass Heart, which is, in case you don't know, Bela Fleck is a banjo player who has went way beyond bluegrass. You know, he started out in bluegrass in the late 70s, but since he was very young, he has always looked for new opportunities to use the banjo and you know, has played all styles of music, and not only played all styles of music, but excelled in all styles of music. I mean, he's got, I don't know how many Grammys, and, you know, there's some bluegrass Grammys in there, but there are also some jazz, some pop, and, you know, all this, just all over the map. Any kind of music is what Bela pretty much has played at all. And so I did a jam session, I guess you could say, during the filming of the documentary I was telling you about. And I haven't played much with Bela, but he was invited to the jam. And he said, well, you know, I probably wouldn't want to be interviewed or anything because I really don't know Mike, but I, you know, it'd be fun to come play or whatever. And so the producer of this documentary said, I think it'd be good if you could learn some of Bela's music. And I said, okay, you know, have him send me a couple things to learn for the jam and I'll do it. And so he sent a couple things and I learned them. And then we got to the jam. I think I had like a day or something to work on them. And they weren't super hard compared to some of the other stuff that he likes to write. So I was able to learn them pretty quick, you know. And then the next day we had this jam, you know, and it was epic jam with like, you know, Ronnie McCurry and Sam Bush and Jerry Douglas and Vince Gill and, you know, all these people who I'd worked with in the past, Del McCurry, all, you know, like, and Bela was there and we played and then we got to the end of the jam and we hadn't played these tunes because, you know, nobody else had learned them. And You know, when you're jamming like that, nobody wants to try and learn something unless you're recording or whatever. So we got done with the jam, and I was thinking, man, we ain't gonna get to play these tunes. And I'd love to play them since I at least learned them, you know. So I said, hey, Bela, let's play this thing. Oh, yeah, you learned that? I said, yeah. And we started playing through it. We played through the whole thing, you know, and I think it was like a medley of about three tunes. And so we played through them, and then we got to the end of that. It's like, well, you learned that awful quick. I said, yeah, well, you know, I did what I could or whatever. And he said, well, do you like to learn tunes? I said, yeah, why not? And he said, well, I don't know, you know, a lot of people don't. And which kind of surprised me, but he said, well, I like to write some really hard music, you know. And I said, well, I'd be into learning it. He's like, all right, I might call you. And he did, you know, and the next thing I know, which I kind of thought, yeah, right, he's going to call me. But, you know, he did. And he said, I'm working on this record. And he was just kind of starting to work on it. And the very beginning versions of a lot of these tunes that ended up on the album. And so that's the other thing that has pushed me in the last few years to go far beyond anything that I've ever done before, and something that I wasn't really sure at one point that I was even going to be able to do, because it is hard. But man, it's such great music, and it's so fun to play, and I'm very grateful to Bela for the opportunity.
Does that scratch a different kind of itch for you musically?
Oh yeah. I mean, as far as, I mean, it's still, I guess, considered bluegrass, you know, it's the bluegrass instruments, but, I don't know if you go listen to the My Bluegrass Heart album, I mean, you're going to hear elements of jazz and blues and rock and, you know, even funk, I would say. You know, I don't even know.
You know, we're on stage. You're playing with your band, Flame Keeper. You guys are on stage, and you're performing, and man, you're just going to town a mile a minute. What are you thinking?
Hold on. That's usually what I'm thinking. But, no, I mean, when it's right, man, you're just... I am usually in the moment. You know, I'm thinking about, man, the band sounded really good. You know, Nathan just played the crap out of that mandolin solo, and man, everybody's grooving, and I can actually hear, you know, the crowd's into it, and it just, at that point, man, there's a place you can get to. And it's hard to find every time. There's ways of doing it, but I never feel like I play as good on stage as I play in my recording booth at home. I'll sit down there and I'll play the most ungodly stuff, and I'll, you know, and then you get out on stage, and sometimes you can get to that point where you just, it's so good and everything's so right, you just play and you don't think. And that's when it starts happening.
But when you hear a place erupt in applause and you know that you've touched those people down deep, what does that mean to you?
Oh, it's the greatest feeling in the world. You know, because you have, you know, not only brought joy to a lot of people, but you've created a diversion for a lot of people. You know, those people who come to see you, and I've heard this said before, and it's true, you never know what they're dealing with, you know? And if you can take them away from their problems, or, you know, make somebody smile or laugh or go buy a bluegrass record, you know, that's just, I mean, we have people come up to us all the time and say, hey, we don't like bluegrass, but we like what you do. And it's like, well, we're bluegrass, you know, but it's great. It's the best feeling in the world.
Were you an alcoholic a few years ago?
I would say probably I was. Yeah. I never did drink every day, but I've never really had the opportunity to drink every day. So, but when I did drink, it was exactly how it is when I play, you know, it was no holds barred, you know, all or nothing, you know. I didn't just drink one beer. It was like a contest. So, yeah, I guess you could say, and I probably really could have been even worse had I had the, you know, had I been able to drive and go get it and all that kind of thing.
Why do you think you drank so much?
Why? It's a very good question, you know. I think part of it now, looking at it, is, you know, I heard a buddy of mine say one time something about continuing your adolescence when you're an adult, or running from the fact of being, you know, running from being an adult or responsibility, which I don't think I was aware of it at the time, but I think maybe part of it was, you know, it's like a lot of people drink, you know, a lot of people, most people, when they do something to, I was watching a self-help video the other day where they said, you know, addiction is a failure to feel. And it really made a lot of sense to me, because whenever you do something like that, you know, whenever you drink or whatever, like, you're avoiding something, or, you know, you're avoiding wanting to think about something, or you're avoiding wanting to feel a certain way, you know, maybe you had something go down that you just don't want to deal with, you know, and maybe there was some of that. And, you know, there's also the fact that I liked how it made me feel, and any drinker will tell you, and this is the truth. If I could go back, and if I could just take the good times that I had with alcohol, you know, it'd be great, but it never works that way. You know, you never know, you never know when it, you just don't know what's going to happen. But, yeah, I liked how it made me feel. And then it was also the fact that, you know, when you're at a bluegrass festival or you're jamming or hanging out, everybody's drinking. And the people that I was around, not all of them, I can't say all of them, but, you know, quite a few people that I was around early on when I was on the road, you know, you didn't drink one beer. Hell, if you drink, you know, you're going to drink at least six, or there ain't no reason to do it, you know. So, I don't know. That could have been, that was definitely part of it.
Then why did you make the decision to stop drinking?
Well, I just got to the point. I mean, I felt terrible. I was very overweight. I was probably the biggest that I'd ever got. And, I mean, I was starting to, I mean, the hangovers hurt worse once you hit about 30. And I think I was about 32, 33, something like that when I quit. And I mean, I just got to looking at it, you know, and just thinking about all the successful people in this music, you know, and I just realized that finally that it wasn't the way to go to do that. And, but mainly I just got tired of feeling bad. I got tired of feeling bad. It was becoming more and more frequent. Anytime I drank, I would have to drink more and more and more. And then I would black out and not know what I did. And, you know, then there's all embarrassing questions and stuff, you know, that from the night before and, you know, waking up. There's nothing worse than waking up and not knowing what the hell you did the night before. And then I found a book, because my people had talked to me about drinking, and I'd had a ton of really embarrassing experiences. And I just started looking up audiobooks on, you know, how to stop drinking or whatever. And of course, everybody was talking about AA, and I found an audiobook called Alcohol Lied to Me. And it was by this guy named Craig Beck. He's called Stop Drinking Expert now. And this book, I think it sold millions of copies. And so his deal was, he wasn't into AA. And but what he did is, and what he does is shows you all the things that, you know, that people say about alcohol. You know, oh, alcohol really makes a party better, you know. And he breaks all these illusions down for you. And, you know, examines all of it. Does it really make a party better, you know? And let's see, red wine's good for your heart. Okay, well, why don't they have, you know, whenever somebody's having a heart attack, you know, why the hell don't they have the doctors, you know, just give them red wine? And that'll fix it. You know?
That's an awfully good question.
Just, yeah, I mean, it's stuff like that's common sense, you know, that you should know and you should be able to think about. But, you know, once you hear it, and then you hear the stuff that he has in his book that he did, I mean, it was just like, you know, the stupid stuff that I did to rationalize my drinking. And it just really struck a chord with me. And I probably had that book for, you know, a couple years or more. And I read it every now and then, you know, every time I, you know, have something like that, really have a bad drinking night or whatever, I'd read this book, and finally I guess it just sank in. But yeah, once I quit. Now I will say also, I've got some really good friends, and the one thing that I did not have to deal with after I stopped drinking, and I know it's the main thing that people get, is peer pressure. And I never did have that. And I think part of the reason that I never had it is because all my friends could see how damn bad I was, and they were just so happy to see me quit. But, like, you know, it took me stopping to realize, oh, yeah, my buddy Aaron here, he's not drinking six beers like I always thought. You know, like, once you're in it, you can actually see, yeah, you know, this guy drinks maybe two beers or, you know, and it's only you, you know, that's carrying it, you know, maybe not always. But it was in my case, you know. And then the guys in Flamekeeper. Because I tried to quit before, and I really didn't want to quit. You know, my dad and a bunch of other people, and just, you know, were saying that I should, and I knew that I should, but that I wasn't ready. And then once I actually decided it was time to quit, I told the guys in the band, and they said, okay, well, let's all quit drinking on the road. And that right there, that was huge for me, because I knew not only did I quit, but I knew I wasn't going to have to worry about it. I wasn't going to have to watch anybody else getting drunk. And because there ain't nothing worse when you're sober and you're not drinking than to sit there and watch a bunch of people who are. And but no, the guys in my band, they really had my back on that, because they all said, all right, we're going to stop too. And they did. And still, we don't drink on the road.
So how has that decision affected your life?
Well, I feel way better. Matter of fact, now, in a lot of ways, I feel better than I have probably in many, many years, because, I quit drinking. I think I started losing weight. I've dropped quite a bit more weight since then, but, I think just quality of life, not having to wonder what you did the night before and not having a hangover when you wake up. And as far as my career, it definitely helped that. You know, like I was still doing okay, you know, but I'd had some embarrassing things happen, like I said, and people knew, you know, people knew that I liked to drink. And it was getting to the point where if I hadn't quit, well, I'll tell you one thing for sure, that I thank God every day that I quit before all the Facebook videos and before the iPhone cameras and all that kind of thing. I mean, man, you know, when you're out somewhere today and you're partying or whatever, anybody could take a video and post it to Facebook at any given time. And I was at Spigma Bluegrass Festival in Nashville one year with a buddy of mine, and we got in this jam, and then right after the jam, we went back to the room and got on Facebook, and there was the jam we were in. You know, somebody posted a live video, and he said, man, just think, if we were drinking during that, that would have been on me. And I'm thankful every day that I quit before that.
Are you a better musician now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know that drinking made, I know I play better now because I feel better now. You know, I weigh about 50 pounds less, and I just think clearly, you know. That's another thing that drinking does, is it just slows down everything, and it's hard to think. But yeah, so I could play, though. You know, a lot of times if I was drinking beer, now I couldn't drink hard liquor, but if I attempted to many times, and prove to myself that I couldn't. But like, I could drink beer, and I got to a point where, I mean, I could drink beer after beer after beer and stand there and play. And like, yeah, I could play to a point even. But I'm definitely, I know I'm a better player now.
Are you working towards something that you can't really see at this point?
No, I think I have a better idea now than I ever have. The things that I'm working on now is, you know, personally, I want to be healthy or healthier. I want to feel good. And so, you know, I work out every day that I'm home and try to eat pretty healthy when I'm at the house. And that's something that I've never did before, you know, before, say, five years ago or so. So there's that. Musically, my goal now is to do more things outside of bluegrass. You know, like, I want to play bluegrass, and I'll always play bluegrass, but I want to reach, you know, I want to play for the audiences who don't know bluegrass. And, you know, I want to continue doing things with Bela Fleck, Tommy Emmanuel, and I'd like to sit in with some jam bands, like Green Sky Bluegrass or String Dusters, or you know, bands like that, rock bands. You know, I want opportunities to play fiddle in other situations, because I think I can do it. I think I'm at the point now where I could do something like that, and it'd be really fun, and it would, I think it would bring my band and bluegrass to a lot of people who haven't heard it before, or people who just think bluegrass isn't anything but, you know, a couple old dudes sitting on the porch, you know, chewing tobacco and playing banjo. You know, I mean, that's what a lot of people still think bluegrass is. And
you think that you guys are kind of helping redefine bluegrass?
I hope so. I know, you know, people like Billy Strings, you know, Billy is, because, and you know, I look at what he's doing, and I think there's hope for bluegrass, because, you know, Billy Strings is at the point where he's selling out pretty much everywhere he plays, and, you know, bigger venues. You know, it used to be clubs. Now he's playing like outdoor venues and arenas and everything else. And, you know, in front of thousands of people and playing these bluegrass songs. And, you know, they play bluegrass instruments, and that's only going to help bluegrass. And so, and I want to record, you know, so I want to, I'm doing a ton of sessions here at the house. I want to keep build that to a point to where I don't have to play on the road when I'm 70 years old, unless I want to. I want to get to the point, you know, I don't want to be out trying to scratch out a living still in bluegrass when I'm 70. You know, I want to be able to just, you know, if I want to, you know, just go do what I want to do at that point and have enough money that I wouldn't have to worry about it.
Your music is going to be around forever. How do you want people from the future to relate to your music?
Well, I know how I feel when I listen to something that I really like. And, you know, it gets me excited. I just want to listen to it over and over and over again. And it just makes me want to play, you know, or to try and do that thing. And if anything that I ever did inspired somebody to want to play, or, you know, if somebody finds a song of mine that they want to listen to over and over again, that they feel that strongly about, and, you know, if it can be said that I was a good musician and all that kind of thing, that'd be fine with me.
And what does it mean for people to look at your situation, what you've overcome, and say you're an inspirational figure who kind of transcends music?
That's hard for me to believe, even. I mean, you know, when you're in it, it's one thing to look at somebody's story from afar, or you know, analyze somebody's playing or whatever. But man, you know, I'm just me, and I've done, and I try to do everything to the best of my abilities, but it's still me. You know, I'm never gonna it's hard for me to see myself in that way, but the fact it's, you know, people do, you know, I really appreciate it. I don't know really how to feel about it. But sometimes it kind of catches me off guard, to be quite honest with you. But if that's the case, man, I'm very grateful.
Thanks to Lane McGivney and all the good folks at Boutwell Studios for all the TLC required to bring this podcast to life. And audio engineers Joe Beeman and Jonathan W. Hickman. Remember, everyone has a special talent. You just need to identify it, cultivate it, and be willing to pay the price. You too can become an American Achiever.